So hello to everybody that's on the call. Once again, I want to welcome each of you personally to the monthly membership call for June. And I hope that some, or actually a lot of you, have taken part in our previous calls. Thanks for joining us. If you have, happy to have you back. And to any of you new folk who are calling for the first time, I'm really glad you decided to join us. So welcome all of you who are taking part in the call tonight. Welcome whoever just joined us. I was just introducing the call. Hi, Carolyn. I'm glad you're back.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, sounds like a couple more people just joined us. Anyway, I was just saying welcome to everybody who's joined the call, and some of you, like Carolyn, who have been on the calls before, thanks a lot, and we're really happy to have you. So, as always, we intend for these monthly calls to provide a forum for more open communication between our members, our member leaders, our groups, and we want to provide a space for you to communicate with other members, share your experiences, ask questions of other members and member leaders. So we're glad to have you be a part of all of this tonight. It's a good experience. My name is Edwin Gore. I'm membership coordinator at Amnesty International in the membership mobilization department. I've worked at Amnesty for a lot of years, and my first work with Amnesty actually was in local group in Manhattan. So tonight, our conversation focuses on the escalating, the growing refugee crisis affecting many countries, including the U.S., and as you might have seen in the news or heard from some politicians, the ranks of refugees worldwide has tested the limits of many countries. So tonight, we will look at Amnesty's work for refugees and then discuss actions to be taken on a community and local level. We'll look at it from top to bottom here. So let's get going with this. I'm happy to present an informed lineup of speakers tonight, each with a deep and specific experience of our refugee work. So tonight we will be joined by Tara DeMatt, who is AIUSA's Senior Director of Identity and Discrimination Unit, Jeffrey Mock, Country Group Specialist for Syria, and Kit O'Connor, State Legislative Coordinator for Vermont. And I would ask whoever is on the call to mute your phone, please. Okay. Now, we will allow for any time for questions you might have, and feel free to share during the call. We will allow time after the speakers have presented. I also have two requests for everybody calling today. Just please remember, as I just said, to mute your phone until you're ready to speak. And then when you do speak, please state your name and then where you're calling from so we know who we're talking to, and it helps all of us. So let's get started. So Tara, could you just introduce yourself, provide a little background, then we can begin.
Yeah, hi y'all. My name is Tara DeMatt, and I lead the Identity and Discrimination Unit. And our priority work in that unit is around women's rights, LGBT rights, the rights of refugees and migrants, and indigenous rights. So, you know, the refugee campaign that's coming up and has already really been in motion for quite a while is a big part of that. I've been a member of Amnesty USA since 2002, I want to say. Been a while. I joined as during the Stop Racist Women campaign and was part of the member leadership for a long time. So, and local group, I was a local group member in St. Louis, Camino Fight for a long time, and then also in the East Bay in California more recently. So I want to speak pretty briefly about the crisis in general and the situation, particularly in the Americas. Jeffrey Mock, our country specialist, is going to speak about the situation, particularly in Syria, which is probably what you're hearing the most about. And then a little bit about the toolkit that we've developed. And Kit, our Vermont legislative coordinator, and I think many, many other things, is going to be talking about what it looks like to try to introduce a local resolution on refugees. So I do want to note that I have to be off the call in after my presentation. So I'll, if there are questions with my piece, then I'll take them then, and I apologize for not being able to stay on. I actually have an 8:30 call because there's no West for the Wicked, so I have two extra questions tonight.
Thanks for being here.
So, yeah, I mean, hopefully most of you have seen a bit about this. You've probably been on webinars with me before. As Kit noted, you've probably received several emails with my name attached, and You've seen the news, certainly, if nothing else. And that means that you know that we are in the largest refugee crisis since World War II. What's more, this is the largest crisis of people on the move. And that means that over 60 million people are currently displaced. That's about one in every 122 people who's been forcibly removed from their homes. Refugees, who are people who are forcibly removed and they cross an international border, they're fleeing for safety and security, for non-discrimination, non-persecution, those are just over 20 million, so somewhere over 20 million. And those numbers are growing every day. And so if you listen to this presentation in January, I think when Jeffrey and I did the first webinar, that number was 19.5 million, right? And we're well over 20 million at this point. The refugee crisis looks different in every region, and the stories, you know, of every individual bear that individuality, but we see similar trends no matter where refugees are coming from. One, someone has to flee across an international, and they make it across an international border, right? Because the state refuses to or cannot protect them. And these are people who are either fleeing war or persecution, targeted persecution, or generalized violence. So Jeffrey's going to talk quite a bit about Syria's specific example. That's certainly a situation you've seen on the news, but there is no populated continent in which we do not have refugees in mass number fleeing. So, for example, again, Jeffrey will talk about Syria, but in the Central African Republic and Eritrea, huge numbers of refugees are streaming into, and actually that's horrifically dehumanizing language, are coming into Kenya, where the two largest refugee camps in the world are located. So Dadaab camp, which is north of Kenya, you know, we think of camp, and I think of camp and I think of camping in the mountains. You know, most refugee camps are sprawling, mile-wide cities, but they're just held together by whatever UNHCR, which is United Nations High Commission for Human, for Refugees, can afford to give, which are the tents that you see, the blue tarps, the UN sort of stamp things, and then whatever food and resources that the UN is able to get in there with the help of aid, whatever aid agencies are able to operate there. So we're talking in many places about huge, huge, unmanaged, many times, camps where people will live, most refugees will live their entire lives in refugee camps. Most refugees will never be resettled. And so that's really important to think about, is that when we're talking about resettlement of refugees, we're talking about a very small percentage, just over 1%, 1.15% of refugees are being called by the UN for immediate resettlement. So that leaves millions and millions and millions of people who will live their lives on the literal and figurative margin of, you know, of societies, of protection, of a life, you know, of dignity. And these camps are hard to protect, and they're out in the middle of nowhere. These are not camps that are set up in fertile ground because they're spaces that governments have given, right? The Dadaab camp is a good example because the Kenyan government, there's over 200,000 people in this camp. Again, we're talking about a sprawling, sprawling city. And the Kenyan government has threatened to shut it down. And what this would mean is that, well, first they'd pull out UNHCR and any aid agencies and protection, and then basically go in and round people up and push them out to nowhere, right? There is nowhere for people to go if they're a refugee. So, you know, there's an example there. In Asia and the Pacific, there are multiple refugee situations. One major crisis is what's often called boat people. For example, the Rohingya, persecuted minority in Myanmar, Burma, have been fleeing over the course of many years. And people are trying to make it by boat down through, you know, Asia Pacific into the islands. Australia, Amnesty Australia actually has been working on a refugee campaign for about 15 years because Australia has closed its borders to anyone arriving by boat, which is, of course, illegal by international laws. And instead, what they're doing is detaining people on the island of Nauru. You might recognize Nauru as being one of the seven islands that hasn't ratified CEDAR, one of the seven countries, we're one of the other ones. Nauru is a very, very, very small, it's like 4 square miles, island nation. And what the Australian government has done is set up what sort of looks like a detention camp. It's like a sort of Gitmo style detention facility where they just ship and then plop down refugees who are, you know, human beings who are then living in prison, oftentimes caged in the conditions that are so hard to imagine. So again, this is, you know, across the globe. Moving to then the United States and the refugee crisis on our own sort of front border, the United States does take in the highest number of refugees of any other country in the world. Now, these are refugees specifically designated by the UN, and this number, we're set to take in 85,000 this year, although the numbers right now are so low, it's hard to believe that will be able to happen. I think we've only taken in about 3,000 right now. With that being said, this doesn't include then people who come to the U.S.-Mexico border. And when we talk about the refugee crisis in the world, oftentimes we're not thinking about those people coming north. Amnesty International considers what's happening in the Northern Triangle, which is Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, to be a refugee crisis. And not because we're, you know, lefty tree huggers, it's because this is by legal definition a refugee crisis. These are people who are fleeing the Northern Triangle north, trying to make it to and through Mexico because of the persecution and the violence and the lack of security, oftentimes targeted violence and lack of security because of the Maras and the drug gangs and cartels down there. And the state has sometimes refused to and sometimes is unable to protect its people. So tens and thousands of people who have been counted, this doesn't include people that have not been caught at borders, have been fleeing north through Mexico to try and make it to safety. El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala are three of the most dangerous countries to live in the world. And that's a sort of statistic that gets bantered around sometimes. And, you know, if you live in Oakland and people say things like that, it's like, what does that mean, right? What it means for those three countries is that the murder rates for Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala are numbers 1, 3, and 5. I think El Salvador is number one. And I think Honduras is number 5, meaning Guatemala's country. So these are places where the murder rate, and these are targeted murders by drug cartels and the Maras, who are taking control of not just neighborhoods, but entire governments and systems of operations, so that it's unsafe to live. And a couple of examples of what this means, you know, the drug cartels and the drug gangs will go neighborhood to neighborhood and demand impuestos, like a type of protection tax, or quote-unquote protection tax. And if you don't pay that, they'll murder you. There's no real, like, in-between where there's rough gap, right? Like, this is where the murder rate is so high. It is targeted violence. The UN has not declared this a refugee crisis. It's a migration crisis under the UNHCR's mandate. And that has a number of political reasons, none the least of which is because the UN agencies are in countries by invitation. And so the UNHCR, which provides services for refugees and migrants, could be kicked out of any of these countries at any given time. But Amnesty International will be launching a report in September, and other humanitarian and human rights organizations and refugee rights organizations have identified this as a refugee crisis, and we are operating with this as a refugee crisis. What this means is that tens of thousands of people are fleeing north, and they have no other option. What's particularly alarming about this crisis, although globally for refugees as well, is that over 50% of refugees, 51% of refugees are children. And that's a huge percentage of refugees who are children. What makes the Northern Triangle situation, again, that's Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, what makes that situation different is the tens of thousands of unaccompanied children who are fleeing north. So in 2014, over 68,000 unaccompanied children from Central America were apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border. Those are just the children who were apprehended. These are not the children who went to Mexico and somehow stayed in Mexico. These are not the children who made it through and were, you know, found family and or strangers or someone to take them in. These are just the children that were apprehended at the border. Last year, there was a pretty significant dip. Only about 48,000 children were apprehended at the border. This is because the U.S. has helped Mexico shore up its southern border, right, because Mexico borders the Northern Triangle. And by militarizing that southern border with Mexico, you can see the logic, right? It stops people, except for that it doesn't, because this year we're on par to exceed the number that we received in 2014. So we're over the mark in June, which would reach 68,000. I think we're just at like 39,000, so just about the same, but even higher. What that means is people are forced to find more dangerous routes. When you close down a border and you militarize the border, when you don't ensure there are asylum processes, people don't just go back to where they'll get murdered. Children just don't turn around. These are children who are marching thousands of miles through the Mexican desert to try and find safety, and they're not going to be deterred by a militarized border because their lives back home are even more dangerous than that. So I spend a little more time on the Northern Triangle because it may be something you haven't heard too much about because it's not getting as much press, frankly, as other refugee crises. And it's something that we at AISA will be working on quite a bit. We will, as most of you know, launch a refugee rights campaign in September. We have been doing a lot of this work for a long time, but we'll be, as part of our strategic goals over the next 3 years, have a very focused campaign. There's a lot of information coming on that. You'll be continuing to get information about that. In that work, we will be working on the global refugee crisis. We will be spending a lot of time working on Syria and the Syrian refugee crisis. Part of that will be ensuring that destination countries, which are mainly Northern Europe, are actually making safe routes through Central and Southern Europe, that they're accepting more refugees, taking in more refugees, and it will mean that the United States needs to take in more refugees and give more money. Again, while we give more than in other countries, we have a huge capacity that is vastly untapped in terms of the number of refugees we can take in. We'll also, of course, be working then on a situation that affects us at our very border, and that Mexico and the United States have helped to create incredibly unsafe conditions. In the United States, the way that people coming to the border are treated is, whether or not they're refugees, whether maybe they're economic migrants, is illegal under every international law. Detaining people because they come to your border is illegal. Putting them in prison without trial is illegal. There's just so many things that are illegal about what we're doing. One of the consequences for those who are fleeing violence and persecution is that they don't go through an asylum process, which is absolutely required through international law. The U.S. asylum process is failing asylees or potential asylees on every level. There are, first of all, people don't know and are not told that they can apply for asylum. People aren't international lawyers, right? Not everybody who flees is a lawyer. And not everybody who flees knows that they have a legal right to ask for safety. And you do have a legal right, no matter where you go in the world, to apply for asylum, to ask for safety. So most people don't even get that chance. If they do get that chance, they could wait months to receive an asylum hearing, or they could just be deported before they have an asylum hearing. If there is an asylum hearing, it's probably not in a language they speak or understand, and they don't have a lawyer. So imagine going to Iceland and seeking asylum and just sitting there listening to people speak Icelandic to you, wondering what's going on, and no lawyers provided, no translator, et cetera. Also, our deportation process in the United States, particularly our fast-track deportation, where someone who, and I'm going to direct quote, looks like they've been in the United States less than 10 days, end quote, can be picked up by border police and deported without process. So there's a number of issues that we'll also address in the campaign regarding our border and the refugee crisis in Central America. We'll also, of course, be responding and supporting the work, particularly on the closure of the Dadaab camp in Kenya. Oops, that's my alarm saying to get on this call. And as well as supporting the work that's being led by Amnesty entities in Asia Pacific. So that's quite a lot of information. I do want to highlight just a few things before, if there are a couple questions about that. Mainly, honestly, Jeffrey and Kit are said experts that I've hardly even mentioned, which is to say that we are launching this campaign, which is in air quotes, which you can't see. I'm making little dinosaur quotes here. And we're launching this campaign in September, but this work has been happening for a long time. Country specialists in Amnesty USA have been working on asylee cases. We are not a casework organization, but oftentimes people apply, you know, they write us for help, and country specialists have been providing that type of help. They need to have a lawyer somewhere else. We don't have a lawyer. We're not able to litigate like that. So that's been happening. Also, we've been responding specifically to the Syria crisis. I'm using we very loosely. Dean Jeffrey has been responding to the Syria crisis and leading Amnesty USA's work on the Syria refugee crisis for, you know, the last 5 years. So there's a number of work that's already ongoing. And there's work that really needs to be done in the lead up to September. And that's the following. we have to be having conversations in our communities about refugees. And I want to go ahead and own that I'm really bad at this. I'm really good at writing letters and going on legislative visits. I'm really good at planning a campaign moment. I'm really good at protesting. All the things that we make amnesty people good at, we actually need to do something slightly different, which is we need to be talking to people about refugees and having conversations in our communities about refugees, because the type of misinformation, hate, and fear, and particularly anti-Muslim hate rhetoric and Islamophobia, is going to mean a severe lack of protection for refugees in law and policy. It has already meant that. So when you hear someone, I'll just use my own example, my beloved Aunt Clara, who's somehow become a lunatic on this issue, you know, saying something or popping off on Facebook or et cetera, like, we need to be engaging, whether or not you engage on an online channel, you know, I'll leave that to you. I think that those fora can be pretty toxic, but we need to be having conversations with our family members, with our communities, with our religious communities, with our Sierra Club members, with our beach party members, and our whatever you belong to, wherever you go, we need to be responding. And the toolkit that Jeffrey will talk a little bit about gives you some talking points about that. Also, I'd say the America I Believe In toolkit, which is more expansive than refugees but replies to hate, bigotry, and Islamophobia, which is very part and parcel with this issue, also gives you tips for that. And we'll make sure that you have that. Maybe we can, Ed, have email if you've been on the call. Or of course, you can always email me at okay, I can't see my email address. It's tdemant, T as in Tom, D-E-M-A-N-T, at AIUSA.org. You can also just Google me. There's only one Tara Demant in the world. Lucky for the world. And so you can find me there. And then we can get you this information because we need to be engaging on this issue. There is so much hate and so much misinformation and xenophobia out there. And that's going to translate into human rights violations writ large. And we're seeing this, and in the D.C. level, we're seeing this at the state and local level, where governors say, we're not going to take in refugees, which, of course, they don't actually have a legal right to do, but they can make life really difficult for resettlement agencies or make life really difficult for refugees. And we've seen 35 bills introduced in Congress specifically banning refugees, half of them which are where only Muslim refugees are banned, half of which are just, like, no refugees at all. We've seen anti-Muslim and Islamophobic bills go in. And so we need to be having these conversations. We will definitely have traditional amnesty actions where we're going to be working on cases, trying to change laws. That's coming, and you're going to see a lot more of that in September. But the reason that Jeffrey and Kit are going to talk to you about doing local work on a resolution for your city council is because this type of rhetoric really matters. You can see that certainly in the election sphere. And where that rhetoric is going. So just a pitch and a plea for us to really push ourselves past our really good skills of writing our legislators, which you absolutely still need to do, and doing your protests, which you absolutely still need to do, and getting your signatures, absolutely. We really need to be having these conversations. So with that, I'll maybe open it to, like, two. I guess I'm already, like, 40 minutes in. I talk so much. So unless there are very specific questions for me, which I'm happy to field, maybe one or two, I can pass it to Jeffrey.
This is Kalyan. Can I just add something really quickly?
Of course.
If folks need to have someone that they might want to, like, role play with in terms of, like, doing, you know, how to engage in these different conversations, mm-hmm. I would highly suggest that you reach out to your field organizer. Pretty much all the field organizers have had training and experience around having these difficult conversations, you know, either with community partners, with members, whatever else. This should just be a resource that folks just reach out to.
Thanks, Kalia. Anything else for Tara?
Hi, this is Ann Roberts. Hi, everybody. Just thank you, Tara. That was great. Great to know.
Yeah, great question. All questions in the form of compliments are very welcome.
Why not?
I will, unfortunately, do have to hop up to another meeting, which just goes to show you. Wednesday night, 8:30. But I leave you in the very, very capable hands of Kit and of Jeffrey and, of course, of Ed and Kalyan and all the other people who are on. And I will see you all on the Internet very soon.
Okay. Thanks so much, Tara.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's take this moment to pass it over to Jeffrey Mock. Jeff, you want to go?
Hi. I've been an Amnesty member since 1987. I am a chair of the Middle East Country Specialist. I'm not sure how many members know about the Country Specialist Program, but we are a collection of more than 100 Amnesty volunteer leaders who have some level of expertise in our countries, in the countries that we cover. And we help coordinate work with between London, the research team, the staff here, and the members, and we try to make the transition from research to action in the grassroots level all go kind of smoothly, and we do that with varying degrees. Now, one of the things that we have been doing is that, and one of the message I want to have is that the Country Specialist Program has been active on refugees for a long time. And I think that a lot of it's been under the radar. I think a lot of Amnesty members think we haven't been doing a lot on refugees. But a number of us regularly write affidavits or testify on behalf of asylum cases. And we have a pretty good record of success on this. So one message I want to have you know is that while I'm glad that I'm glad we're having this campaign, and I'm glad we're actually hiring a campaigner on staff. But it's important that you know this isn't new work for Amnesty, and we have a vast amount of experience that we're going to be working on. Now, my area is on Syria, and I've been the country specialist since around 2012. And I want to start very quickly by telling you the origin story of the Syrian uprising, because it's important for you to know how we approach human rights in Syria, but also this origin story is totally destroys some of the myths about Syrian refugees. And the way the Syrian uprising started was in 2011, a group of children in the city of Dara wrote graffiti on the walls saying it was time for change to come to Syria. The children were arrested and allegedly tortured, and torture in Syria is extensive and traumatic. This was too much for the people of Dara, and they took to the streets, most of them mothers, in protest, and they were met with violence by security forces. This spread to other cities, and the president, Bashar al-Assad's government, brutally suppressed these mass protests. The violent response sparked the region's most severe armed conflict, and we'll go into the numbers in a moment. But according to the UN, more than 250,000 people have been killed since 2011, and war crimes and crimes against humanity, mostly by the Assad government, but by all sides as well, are rife. Now, why is this important? Because since the beginning of the refugee crisis, I have heard repeatedly from people in power here in the U.S. who should know better that Syrian refugees are, choose your epithet, your comment, Trojan horses for ISIS. They are terrorists. They are criminals. They are extremists. They are cowards who won't fight for what they believe. They are seeking economic gain. And they are lazy people who want European and American welfare. They want American cable television. Now, when you hear that, when you hear comments like that, I do ask that you remember how that the Syrian uprising started through the peaceful expression of free political views by a group of children who were met with violence and torture. It's that desire for freedom of political speech that is at the center of what the Syrian uprising is about. There's no question it's been complicated since it started, but it's been mostly complicated by the fact that there are a myriad of external countries who are all using Syria and fighting proxy struggles for regional power inside of Syria, rather than try to build a society based on the vision of the children and the mothers of Dara that started the uprising. So, with that message, and I hope that's one thing that you'll remember from this, let me go quickly into the numbers. Again, close to 250,000 people killed. There are nearly 13 million Syrians in urgent need of humanitarian assistance within Syria. Around 8 million of them are considered internally displaced people, which means they have left their home. Many of these IDPs are trapped and surrounded by both Syrian and rebel forces and are facing gunfire on a regular basis and unable to get humanitarian access. The bottom line is more than 50% of the pre-conflict Syrian population have had to flee their homes since the conflict started. The humanitarian appeal for Syrian refugees is just 40% funded. And people are, Syrian refugees in Lebanon are receiving $13.50 a month to live on. 80% of the Syrian refugees in Jordan live below the poverty line. It's worth noting that the U.S. has met its pledge, but it's fallen short in other areas, which we will talk about in a bit. There are now, and I just got updated numbers today, $4.8 million Syrian refugees registered with the UN as refugees. 95% are living in five Middle East countries: Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt. It's a tremendous burden on these countries. But right now, they're taking them pretty much alone. They're taking the burden pretty much alone. When you hear that the Middle East is not stepping forward to taking care of their own people, do understand that most of those, overwhelmingly, almost all of those 4.8 million are in Middle Eastern Islamic countries. Now, Amnesty has gotten a lot of attention for their calls for Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries to take in Syrian refugees. And frankly, the numbers that Saudi Arabia and Bahrain has taken amounts to zero so far. So we are not asking for this burden to fall on any single country. In fact, the opposite. We're asking everyone to step forward and show leadership to what they can. Now, the important thing about that 4.8 million, million refugees is that the UN, based on their experience, has declared this number unsustainable. They believe it will lead to instability, and it already has in some of the neighboring countries. We do not want this to happen. We do not want the instability in Syria to spread to Lebanon, to Jordan, to Turkey. It already has in some ways, but they really need to make sure it doesn't overflow the borders. And one of the ways that they need to do this is by resettling around 10% of those 4.8 million refugees. Right now, the UN is just looking for resettlement of around 450,000 refugees. They have identified around 200,000 of those refugees for resettlement. That means they need to identify another 250,000. But the bottom line is that no country, we haven't even come close to meeting the UN goal. And of those 200,000 that they have identified for resettlement, only a small portion have actually been resettled. What I want you to take away from this is that the AI and the UN both believe these refugees can't safely return home, and that's not going to change anytime soon. The refugee resettlement process involving the UN is lengthy, takes 2 years, is extremely detailed and very safe. Only those Syrian refugees registered by the UN and as being identified as being particularly at risk or vulnerable are considered for resettlement. Globally, the UN gives priority to the most vulnerable refugees, including torture survivors, people with serious medical conditions, children traveling alone, and women and children at risk. Now, these do not, the point is, this is safe. But the other thing that you need to take away is because the world has not stepped up and made use of this safe, carefully vetted UN resettlement process, what has happened? The Syrian refugees have taken it into their own hands. And this is where we get the tens of thousands of Syrians taking to the Mediterranean in a very dangerous situation where they just come on into borders for countries that are not prepared to take them and have a difficult time vetting people, because when you climb into a boat that's in these situations, you're taking only a few objects, and usually it's not the documents that you need to become registered as a refugee. So when you hear all of the concerns about what's going on the Mediterranean Sea, understand that one of the key reasons why that's happening is because the world has delayed and fallen short on using the very safe and closely vetted UN process of resettlement. The two get confused very easily. The people that went through the Mediterranean are not part of the resettlement program. They will not be coming to the U.S. under resettlement anytime soon. Conceivably, years down, they could be after they go through resettlement. But right now, the people that are qualified for resettlement are the ones that are still in the Middle East and do have their papers and have had the security checks. So that's why you should be, when talking to neighbors, feeling confident about why this process works. It has worked in dozens of other refugee crises. This isn't the first refugee crisis. This isn't the only refugee crisis born out of terrorism. It's worked many other places, and it will work in Syria if we will just let it happen. But the bottom line is the U.S. has not stepped up. Since 2011, the U.S. has taken over little more than 3,000 Syrian refugees. The U.S., the Amnesty International is asking the U.S. to take 100,000. So we're not even asking the U.S. to take, we're asking them to take less than a quarter of all of the refugees the U.N. is trying to resettle. But we're not even coming close to that. At the beginning of the year, President Obama pledged that we would take 10,000 Syrian refugees. We don't think this is sufficient. But even this puny little goal, we are going to fall significantly short of reaching. We're halfway through the year, and we're a little bit between 2,000 and 3,000 that we have taken. And the Department of State has openly admitted that it's going to be very challenging to meet even the reduced goal that the very moderate goal that President Obama set. Okay, I want to finish up so that we have questions, but here is what Amnesty is doing, and here is what you can do. Amnesty is done a solidarity program called Open to Syria, and also a wider one on Welcome Refugees. So we are trying to use this kind of campaigning to show the refugees they haven't been forgotten and ignored, which is essentially what they feel like they have been. But we had just on World Refugee Day, some of you may have taken part of the action where you wrote letters to refugees. This is something that it's very simple action, but for them to know that they haven't been forgotten is very important. We are calling on the world to fully fund the humanitarian crisis, and we're pressing neighboring countries like Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, to keep their borders open and follow international law. We are opposing restrictions in Congress and in the State Department, and we're working on the human rights of refugees in the camps themselves. Very early on, we did a very successful campaign to make sure that the restrooms in the refugee camps, in one of the largest refugee camps, had light bulbs, so that women could go to the bathroom at night and feel safe from, because large numbers of them were going into the dark and getting sexually assaulted. We saw a significant change in the safety situation after that campaign. And finally, we're continuing our focus on human rights inside of Syria, because bottom line is the refugee crisis won't stop until the human rights abuse is there and there. Okay, so what are we asking you to do? Our idea is that we need to change the narrative. Those comments about Syrians, refugees being Trojan horses, those comments are still dominating a lot of the national dialogue. We need to change the narrative, and we're going to do it the ground up. We are asking you as members to engage in grassroots work, getting your local community and your local legislators understanding that resettlement of refugees, with Syrian refugees within the larger scope of the global campaign, is something that will benefit both the United States and the refugees themselves, and that it is safe and that all this misinformation that has gone around can be countered. So we're asking you to do this. The Refugee Toolkit is the main tool for you to do that. I wrote that up about a year ago, and I took sort of a kitchen sink approach that I threw a lot, anything that I thought would be useful in there. Tara brought on Sarnato Reynolds, who was formerly on our staff, to go through that and improve it, and I think she's pared it down to the most essential, and I think it's a lot easier read and will be more useful. But the toolkit includes talking points, sample op-eds, sample petitions, sample letters to the editors and to the legislators, social media content. But the priority was asking you to go to your local communities and get resolutions passed by your city council and county council. The idea is that that would then percolate up and that people at the politicians at the higher level would take notice of what's happening among their constituents. To do so requires partnerships. We don't expect Amnesty members to do it on their own, and there are often refugee organizations in your community who can be very helpful. And with that, I will just stop and let Kit go on and talk about how she did exactly what I'm talking about right there. So,
okay.
Go ahead.
Before we go on, let's open it up to questions, see if anybody has anything to ask him. Any questions?
I have a question.
Jeff?
Mm-hmm. Please.
My name is Ron Colburn from Philadelphia. I wonder if you could say a word about the international law on refugees.
Well, that's a pretty big topic.
Can you put it in five sentences? Where did it come from, and what does it entail?
Well, here's the lesson here's the main thing you need to know about international law is that it does not require any country to accept refugees, but it gives refugees basic rights of safety, It has the right of refoulement, which means they cannot be returned to a place where their lives will be in danger. So it's in that part, and it came out of an international covenant. There have been two. The U.S. did not sign the first. They did, were a party to the second. So they're generally considered to be part of the whole shebang. But that, what's happening is the Syrian refugee crisis is exposing this contradiction within the international agreements, that while refugees have detailed rights, no country has any obligation to actually step forward and make sure those rights are protected. So there's a lot of discussion that they need to be rewritten coming out of this crisis. Again, I could go into it. Tara is excellent on this, but the bottom line is that the international laws are finding themselves to be inadequate to deal with a crisis of this stature. They were written in the aftermath of the refugee crisis of World War II, and they sort of respond to that kind of situation. And the current situation is much different. So that's a weakness that needs to be addressed.
Okay. Is there anyone else?
Thank you.
Anyone else have a question for Jeff?
Hi, this is David Davenport with the Amnesty International Capitol Hill Group in Washington, D.C. And I have a question about responding to concerns over budget issues. I know that this might seem a little bit off the beaten path, but in areas that are more liberal, I see the challenge might not be necessarily combating xenophobia and Islamophobia, but convincing people that they should still welcome refugees even though they might not think that they have it in their budget. I was wondering if you had any sense of what that argument is like on the national level, and if you had any ideas for counter-arguments to that.
Well, most people don't understand that when refugees get resettled, that they are guaranteed a set period of time of support. They get a little bit of income for this set period. They get some housing stipends. That set period is 3 months. Beyond 3 months, they're on their own, and they're on the goodwill of sponsors. So in terms of government budgets, the refugee resettlement is not a significant factor because they get so much. In terms of nonprofits, I can see that being a challenge. And that's one of the reasons why we do ask amnesty groups when they try to use the toolkit to connect with local refugee organizations, because you want to make certain that they are prepared to take and support refugee resettlement, resettled refugees, before you start going waving the flag and saying, we're ready for refugees. The burden does not fall on government. The burden generally falls on the nonprofit and non-governmental sector. The financial burden, that is.
Okay. I do want to make sure that Kit and Carolyn get a chance to speak here. So let's move on to Kit, please.
Yeah, my name is Kit O'Connor, and I'm the legislative coordinator in Vermont, as you've heard. I've been doing it all as long as since just this past September. I'm a teacher and a mediator by trade, although I'm not currently doing either of those for a profession. I'm finding myself doing a lot of it in this resolution process. And I would ask to speak about the climate strategies in Vermont, and then the leadership that Vermont Amnesty groups have taken, and then what we've been working on. So I will do that with a little bit of we're going to change that up just a little bit. So I'll speak about the climate for refugees in Vermont and then hand it over to Carolyn Smiles, our AC here in Vermont, if that's okay. So
yes.
First, I have to start off with just saying that our Governor Peter Shumlin, he spoke out really loudly and very strongly in support of Syrian refugees when the governors nationally were vowing to prohibit refugees from settling in their state. And I think that that really helped set a tone. That being said, soon thereafter, I was at a rally, a refugees welcome rally, particularly Syrian refugees. And on the other side, in the counter rally, was a current gubernatorial candidate. And he was really speaking some xenophobic rhetoric. So with that background, Vermont has a field office to the United States Committee on Refugees and Immigrants, also known as the USCRI. It's called the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program, and we may refer to it as the VRRP. It's located near Burlington. Carolyn and I were just there today, and then we decided that rather than, you know, depending on anecdote to talk about the climate here, we would ask them. So we asked, and we were told that overall the climate in Vermont toward refugees is quite positive. There have been some incidents, like students on buses being told to go home. There was, I think a woman was, I don't know exactly what happened to her, but there was some physical violence, although I'm not sure if that was, again, an anecdote. But she said overall it's pretty positive. One town was some backlash to resettling. Actually, they were going to settle or are settling Syrian refugees there, and there was a bit of backlash, but resettlement there is also really new. The community didn't see it coming. So other than that, a lot of the concern has been around, you know, fear for scarcity of money or services, which kind of goes to what the gentleman was saying earlier. And overall, while it's positive, I will say that she told us today that the SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center, is monitoring at least one hate group in Vermont, and I think because she was speaking in regards to refugees, it may be probably related to some kind of, I don't even know, I don't want to quote anyone. And then other than that, there have been like rumors that, you know, that are now debunked about refugees having tuberculosis and the other kind of things that Jeffrey was talking about earlier. So that being said, I'm going to just hand it over to Carolyn to just briefly talk about what other groups are doing in Vermont, because we are not the only people doing anything.
Okay, thanks, Kit. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I'm unmuted. Well, every state in our country for many, many years in our country's history has resettled refugees. I'm just going to start from about 30 years ago with efforts in Vermont, and some of those are still going through different groups. So even before Vermont Refugee Resettlement formed in 1989, Vermont Refugee Assistance formed, and that ran from about 1987 to 2014. And I was on their board for about 10 years, and we worked with asylum seekers, but we also had, I guess what you could say, was an underground railroad. And during the beginning of our time, we had a lot of Central American and South American folks trying to get to the border of Canada. And we ended up housing for a long time many, many families and individuals through this underground railroad until they could get appointments at the border in Canada. And so Vermont Refugee Assistance ended up changing its name after Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program formed and changed their names to Immigration and Asylum Advocates. And only recently in the last 2 years has that declined mostly due to funding. But the director of that is now still working and runs a legal assistance program through a new group in Burlington called the Association of Africans Living in Vermont. So there still is a legal assistance program run through that agency for refugees. And then the former staff attorney for Vermont Immigration and Asylum Advocates has set up shop through the South Royalton Legal Clinic, and she works on some asylum applications and humanitarian cases. The director the former director still goes into the big prison in New York State that now houses asylum seekers that still come into our airports and then get shipped all over. We used to have a few prisons here, county prisons, you know, that would have refugees sitting there for quite a while until Vermont Refugee Assistance began to represent them. But now a lot of the people go right over to this big prison in New York State, so we do have representation there. Then, of course, the RRP formed, and I just want to quickly mention some other support groups and that support refugees, and one of them is, well, the Peace and Justice Center here helps to sponsor events, such as the big concert for Syrian refugees that was just, we just had two months ago, and that was actually organized by a local pianist, Michael Arnowitz, with the help of the former ambassador to Syria. He was Mr. Ford and his wife. He was the ambassador, I think, 2012 to 2014, and maybe, Jeffrey, you can correct me if I'm wrong there, but he and his wife have recently moved to Vermont, and so they, along with the piano player, just had a big concert, and I can explain where all those funds are going. There is a Vermont Fund for Syrian Refugees now that has formed through that Michael Arnowitz and that concert. And then there's also a program run through the University of Vermont. Well, there are two programs that deal with torture and trauma. And one of them is called Connecting Cultures, and it's a mental health program that has services for refugees, since a great percentage of refugees have experienced torture, it seems. And then the other part is the New England Survivors of Torture and Trauma, run through through the medical center at UVM. And that serves anybody who's had torture and trauma, but really definitely serves survivors of torture and trauma of new Americans. So we have quite a few organizations that do assist refugees, but we have so much work to still do, as Kit and I both know. When I went to a demonstration recently when Trump came, rented our big theater hall here and bussed in people from all over, I'm sure there were many Vermonters here who were still in that phase of take back Vermont from the Civil Union days. There was a person in front of me on the other side of the street. Of course, I had my Trump, anti-Trump banner, but and was silent. But there was a KKK person there, you know, with a white hood on. So we still have a lot of work to do here, but we have some great efforts that have been going on for many years, and we can tap into some of those. And we have a huge resettlement city, you know, a huge resettlement area in Burlington and in Winooski, which is where Kit and I, and Kit with the lead, will be introducing our resolutions. So let's see, I think that's a little history of refugee resettlement, at least from the last 30 years. So we have a great deal of support, but we also have some new concerns, you know, from people who are worried about services going to refugees and not to the homeless population that's here. But there's, you know, I think Kit and I have some good information to share with people. And then Kit's going to now share, I guess, where we stand with our refugee resolution process.
I just wanted to, thanks so much, Carolyn. I appreciate that. Carolyn, she knows the history of this area. And it's so cool. But, you know, because there's so many active groups in Vermont and there's so much going on and we have so many people doing, you know, so many different things, I honestly can't say that any amnesty group has taken leadership. I think that what we're trying to do is find a niche into which we can fit. And so once we got in this process started, you know, we're hoping that we can have a real conversation with some of these other people we consider community partners. And we'll be getting together and having like a round table that our field organizer, Cynthia Gabriel Walsh, will be helping us to put together. So to fit the niche, we wanted to find a space. Like I said, I'm a teacher, and Carolyn's a teacher. So we wanted to find a space for education and conversation. And then I was, I guess, bored one day and just looking through the Syrian Refugee Toolkit, and that local resolution, the resolution to the city council to support resettlement of Syrian refugees in your hometown, in this case we're starting with Burlington, just seriously just popped on me. And I thought, you know, if we're going to, if we're hoping to start a larger community conversation, I mean, starting with your local city council made a lot of sense. So though the city, the resolution is symbolic, the work that we're doing to get that passed is much more than that, I think. So we made contact with our refugee resettlement program that Carolyn was just speaking. They actually got in touch with their national office in D.C. and gave us the green light because, you know, we would have had trouble going ahead if we didn't have their backing. So that was really important. I will say, just based on experience, that these organizations are incredibly busy. So plan some time into the communication back and forth. And then so far we've successfully approached a few of our city councilors that we thought would be friendly to our cause. And this is a brief hint or tip for how I found an easier way to do it is I just sort of watched their Twitter feed, not in a stalking way, but just in a, I wonder what this city council is up to. And I found out that, one in particular is actually looking for something to do to help refugees. And so that gave us a lot of information, and we started there. We have a basic outline of how we want to approach. It's a little bit on hold because we're waiting for one more meeting with our resettlement office, which we're hoping will happen hopefully as soon as tomorrow. But then one of the things that we're planning on doing is then if there are a few city councilors, and we are a city of, I think, under 40,000. It's the largest city in Vermont, but it's under 40,000. So that just gives you a little bit of perspective. But we're hoping to go to meet with some of the more resistant counselors face-to-face and sit down, and we'll have, all our ducks in a row. And then hopefully when we have some help from some community partners and our refugee resettlement program office, and also hopefully it's some city counselors and also our student activist coordinators who are really good, then we're hoping to put together an educational and a question-and-answer forum. So going to that, opening up some conversation and education and try to demystify a lot of this this rhetoric that's just so painful. I think the key to this success hinges in part on the relationships we make. I think this goes to what Jeffrey was saying about and to what Tara was saying about, you know, in your life, talk about stuff. And I think that this is going to be incredibly important for us. And also how we approach people, because people are around here anyway, are coming from a place of fear. And when people come from a place of fear, I personally don't want to put them on the field because I don't think that'll change anything. So we are anticipating some anger, and we're pre-planning how to deal with that, hopefully with a heart full of grace and a soul generated by love, as Martin Luther King said. Like my favorite thing on my Twitter feed, if you ever look at my Twitter feed. Anyway, but I'm realistic, and I know that it could still be a problem, so we will have allies there, and also because it's a small city, you know, we know who the community liaison officers are, so we have all these, we know the local businesses, we have, I think we have a lot of contacts, and that's going to be to our benefit, and also our refugee resettlement program has a lot of great information that they can use, help, lend to us, and then I guess I'm going through this really fast because I know it's late. But a final thought is that the people from the Refugee Resettlement Office here were very clear to us that, you know, make sure that people know that even if a resolution doesn't pass, it doesn't necessarily give them the right to deny refugees admittance. And I think Tara and Jeffrey both spoke to that. But ultimately, our goal is to help educate and combat some of the phobia. So, there. Hope I did that fairly quickly.
Okay. Well, we're a little bit over time, but I'm willing to take any, we can last a few seconds here if you have any closing questions. Any questions for Kit or Carolyn or Jeffrey?
Hello?
Yes.
This is Young Min Kwan, originally from D.C. I'm the social media coordinator for the Capitol Hill Group at the Anne Community of D.C. I just have a very specific question about reaching out to allies on social media. I'm directing this question primarily to Tara and Jeffrey. Obviously, the Amnesty account should be the primary Twitter piece that we should try to retweet and support. But in terms of our allies, could you suggest a few organizations that you want us to pay particular focus on? We've been following groups like the Refugee International, that started another Reynolds group, the Refugee Council USA, UNHCR Washington
Office. Right.
So, yeah. So you get
you're on the right track, right there.
Okay.
Especially RCUSA. We're in regular contact with them. And, in fact, we joined the 100,000 numbers that we are requesting out of the U.S. government came in negotiations with them.
So the welcome 10K hashtag, right?
Yeah. But let me also emphasize, for those of you who aren't in Washington, D.C., there is in the toolkit a link that tells you what groups are in your community that are on the ground actually helping refugees, resettled refugees, in their transition. And they're very important that you reach out to them because, again, they're the ones that know the situation on the ground. They know whether it's safe to bring in Syrian refugees or any kind of refugees right now. And they're the ones that actually have to deal with the refugees. So nationally, RCUSA and the other ones that you meant, Catholic Workers, that's CWS, World Relief, that's another organization. But most of those are actually all part of RCUSA. So those are the key ones. But you also need to reach out to the ones at the lower level, on the grassroots level in your community, if you're not in D.C.
Can I answer that really quickly? This is Kit. When we're going to our city council people, if we did not have the backing of our local refugee resettlement, they would not really pay much attention to us. So it's really that's the place to start if you want to do, whether it's legislation or something else. They really want to know that you're not, you know, that you have the refugee people behind you.
That's perfectly.
Go ahead. I know we're running out of time. This is Terry in Oregon, and I have a question. Do you work with faith communities? The reason I say that is I'm part of a little Unitarian church, and there one of the people here has interest in refugee issues, and they're working with and immigration issues, and they're working with a local Oregon group. And then also I know that there's several churches, faith groups in Eugene, Oregon, which is about 2 hours south of Portland, took in a refugee family at the behest of the Catholic bishops, you know, the Catholic refugee group. So what role do they play in your movement?
Well, with what we're doing so far, I mean, we're doing it specifically as Amnesty through our refugee resettlement. That being said, we have a lot of different faith groups in the Burlington area that are working toward refugee issues. And so what we're trying to do is, with this resolution, we want to actually draw their support, and we would be the lead on this. But then we would also be there to support them, and we want to end up having a community roundtable. And it would include faith groups if they are working that are also – it wouldn't just be non-faith groups. It would be all. Yeah, so –
that's what I'm thinking of.
I'm always a little careful just because I just remember being at an LC, my only ever LC institute, and being warned about being careful who you align with. But, But I think we're all going to try to end up supporting each other somehow. We're just not quite there yet.
Yeah, I hope so because I wear different hats, but I'm part of the social justice for the Unitarian. But also, Amnesty provides the action, and I know with the death penalty we align with faith groups, and I'm hoping that to do the same thing with issues like this.
Mm-hmm. I think we do.
Keeping what Amnesty's party line is,
Right, exactly.
Somehow you can do it, yeah.
Thank you.
We're planning on you know, becoming allies. We're just, you know, we're not quite there yet. I mean, I think so. Wouldn't you say, Carolyn?
Yes, I agree. And there are different social justice groups and in different churches here and faith organizations. But we will be inviting people from all of the faith groups, you know, to the community meeting that we end up having.
Great.
All right. Thanks for your question, Terry.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Okay.
And I'll just lend my support to that. Yeah, I mean, they're a ready group, and they're usually working with the refugee organizations on the ground. Almost all the sponsoring agency and nonprofits helping refugees in a community have some sort of faith tie.
Yeah, and Jeffrey, I'll just follow up. Like, if there is I'm assuming that if there is a concern about an issue or where the line is, we can always ask Jeffrey or Deanna Colucci or somebody. Because I'm well aware of that too. I don't want to Amnesty. You know, I'm always aware of Amnesty's brand.
Don't restrict yourself to them, but they're an ally on this issue in most cases.
Oh,
so.
No.
You need them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How else are we going to get stuff done unless we do coalitions?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks. I guess, is that anyone else? Probably. It's getting late, and we probably should close so we can all go on to our lives. Anyway, I'd like to thank our wonderful speakers for making themselves available this evening and for sharing their knowledge and their expertise with all of us today. And thanks to everybody who called in to take part in the call, and I will just invite you to join us again on July 20th for our next call. Okay.
Thanks so much, Ed. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. And if you, if anyone needs to follow up on the call, please contact me, egur@aiusa.org. All right.
Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Have a good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Good night.